Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And look, just a quick housekeeping note before we get going. Apple Podcasts has had a bit of a meltdown over the last couple of weeks, and this is a situation that's affecting an awful lot of podcasts, ours included. And the upshot is basically Apple users just aren't getting some podcasts, or at least they're not getting them on time. Last week's episode actually took 5 days to make it into the iTunes feed. So I would recommend that people switch over to another podcast app like Pocket Casts or Overcast and just subscribe to our RSS feed. And that way you'll get podcasts like these when they're published, not 5 days later, if at all. So end housekeeping note. On this week's show, Adam Boileau will be along in just a moment to talk about the big story of the week, the shutdown of the Colonial Oil Pipeline in the eastern United States. We'll be talking about some other news, of course, but yeah, this is a story that deserves a deep dive, and Chris Krebs, the former head of CISA in the United States, will also be joining us to discuss that. And then we're going to hear from this week's sponsor, Okta. Aaron Parecki is a senior security architect at Okta. He's also been a spec editor and member of the OAuth working group at IETF for nearly 11 years, so he knows a thing or two about OAuth, and he'll be joining me after the week's news to talk through the latest OAuth guidance the IETF is going to release. That is a very interesting chat, and it is coming up after the week's security news, which starts now. And Adam, I'm guessing unless our listeners have been all hiding under rocks for the last 5 days or so, they would know that a major oil pipeline in the United States, this is, I saw one article describe it as not a pipeline, it's the pipeline. It supplies something like 45% of the East Coast's energy or fuel needs. That pipeline has been shut down after the company that owns it was hit with a ransomware attack.
Yeah, the story goes that they appear to have been ransomwared on the corporate side. Some ransomware operators got in, encrypted some data, stole some data, the usual sort of thing, and they ended up kind of shutting down the network to respond to that, and that has either impaired their ability to operate their pipeline on the kind of operational technology side, or there was some, you know, kind of further intrusion to that sort of thing. We haven't really seen, you know, anything other than the fact that the oil isn't flowing, you know, as an indicator that, that's what happened. There's been plenty of conversations around the InfoSec Twitter and so on, you know, a lot of people becoming instant operational technology experts. But, you know, one suggestion is, hey, maybe it's hard to bill for things when your corporate side is down, and maybe, you know, sending the oil out without billing for it's difficult. But for whatever reason, they went through a process of having to kind of shut down pipeline operations. And then the process of restarting that when you're, you know, kind of bringing things back, also really complicated, it looks like.
Yeah, and they're not fully back up and running. And I think when this first happened, I saw a article which said, it quoted some energy expert as saying that, like, if they don't get this thing back up and running properly sort of Wednesday, Thursday, there's going to be some serious problems in the United States. Already we're seeing people in some states panic buying fuel at service stations. I mean, there's pictures all over the internet of people loading jerry cans into the back of their SUVs. This is turning into a big deal. I mean, we've even got emergency declarations from some states. I mean, you can ransomware hospitals, you can ransomware the DC police, but you know, you mess with America's oil, and a whole different game at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this has certainly made an impact in ways that, you know, those previous examples of, you know, hospitals and whatever else, schools and things, probably should have.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, yeah, you mess with America's oil, that's a thing that kind of goes straight to the heart of of what it means to be an American. And
well, yeah someone's asking for some extreme freedom. At this point, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm calling it Operation Internet Liberation, which of course the acronym is OIL. This could be the ransomware op.
But I mean, this is, you know, this is a really big deal. And even if it is just, you know, it's pretty, by the look of it, pretty common garden kind of ransomware, and not really targeted as, you know, a thing that's meant to disrupt, you know, energy supplies for a country. But that kind of doesn't matter because, you know, that's the position they're in. And, you know, whether those supplies are disrupted because of, you know, preventative action, whether they're, you know, whether the shortage is now because people are panic buying, or, you know, because, you know, the people are pumping it out of the gas station tanks faster than they can pump it back in again at the moment, or,
well,
you know,
it's
whatever.
It's toilet paper syndrome. It's 2020 paper buying syndrome, and that's what it is. There's not a real supply shortage yet, but everyone's worried about the supply shortage, which is creating a supply shortage.
Yeah, exactly, which is, that's the good sort of just-in-time logistics world that we live in now. And, you know, you could absolutely see this kind of pattern happening in other, in other industries. And indeed, you could see this, you know, kind of, you know, flowing on into, you know, gas-powered electricity generation, or, you know, all sorts of other, you know, ways that the energy ecosystem, you know, depends on everything working exactly as the way that it's supposed to, and clearly it's not at the moment.
Well, I think everybody who listens to this show regularly would know that we've been saying this stuff is going to escalate for quite a while. So I can't say I'm tremendously surprised that this has happened. I do think, though, that there's been a lot of hair splitting on Twitter about whether or not Russia is culpable on this, right? Now, obviously, even US President Joe Biden said that Russia is, as to the best that their intelligence services over there can determine, Russia is not, you know, directing this attack or anything, but that Russia is still partially responsible. I mean, this is from the lips of the US president. Let's take a listen to that.
Do you think Russia is involved at all implicitly with that attack?
I'm going to be meeting with President Putin, and so far there is no evidence based on from our intelligence people that Russia is involved, although there is evidence that the actor's ransomware is in Russia. They have some responsibility to deal with this.
So, I mean, there you have it, right? From President Joe Biden in the United States saying that, you know, there is some responsibility there. I don't think it really matters whether or not this is a state-directed attack. The fact that this attack, you know, originated in a country that is giving free kicks all day long to ransomware crews, they're going to have to wear some of the blame here.
Yeah, I mean, there's this kind of continuum between, you know, state-operated, state-sponsored, down to kind of like state-sanctioned or tolerated, and exactly where on that spectrum it is, you know, we can argue about, but certainly there is some degree of responsibility, and the way that, you know, ransomware operators and other, you know, cybercrime operators have been just kind of allowed to run in Russia as long as they, you know, play by the rules, and there's a bunch of, you know, reasons why that makes sense for a state like Russia to tolerate or encourage or support. And, you know, regardless of exactly where on that spectrum we decide, you know, the wonks decide that it's going to be, there's still some degree of culpability, you know, and some degree of responsibility, or at least some degree to be part of the solution from Russia, right? And if it was in a country like, say, Iran, where, you know, these things are more aligned with the state interests, you don't really expect the Iranians to be part of the solution. Here with Russia, you know, maybe the US does have enough leverage. I don't know. I guess we're going to find out.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's going to be a hell of a conversation, one would think, right? meanwhile, the people who did this, I mean, they're affiliates of the DarkSide ransomware operation. What's really funny is DarkSide is absolutely shitting bricks over this, putting out statements saying, we're not a political thing. And, you know, in future, and this is really funny, in future, they're going to throw targets in. Like, if when an affiliate submits a target, they're going to do moderation on it to make sure that it's, like, not anything too hectic, which to me just, I mean, why would you be a customer of DarkSide at that point if you're going to get held up in a mod queue? Like, the whole thing is just insane.
It is quite funny, like, seeing them having to kind of deal with some of the sorts of same problems that, you know, like a Facebook or a Twitter or any other, you know, platform operator has to go through to kind of moderate what its users do now that they are being held responsible for what their users have done. And, like, seeing that play out in the crime ecosystem is quite funny in a way.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it is interesting. Like, the tone of that announcement from them really did seem like there was some, you know, some big regret energy, I think someone said on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's really funny because we were talking about, oh, the people who attacked the DC police have gone too far. And then, you know, it really is a hold my beer moment. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, look, it was my great pleasure this morning to conduct this this quick interview with Chris Krebs, of course, the former head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, in the United States. These days, he's working with Alex Stamos at Krebs Stamos Group, a consultancy. And I started off by asking him if he thinks this is a true watershed moment. And as you'll hear, you know, he does think that because this is an incident that's touched so many people. Here he is.
So this one hit home. I think, unfortunately, the human condition is that it has to be kind of experienced personally before it really resonates. And one would think that WannaCry or NotPetya were those watershed moments, but the majority of the impact there was felt overseas in the UK and elsewhere. But this is the first, kind of like the 2016 election where, oh my God, you know, we've got cyber and we've got disinfo. I mean, this thing is specific to Colonial. This is a cyber effects operation effectively. And then I think the second thing that makes this such a pivotal watershed moment is it's still early in the Biden administration, who has doubled and tripled down on cybersecurity as a key facet of his administration with some really top-notch nominations and hires. And they have to show, they have something to prove here. And I think to date, it's been a fairly admirable or commendable performance from the podium and from some of the engagements. So where I think the scope is going to eventually creep back over to is, you know, what did Colonial Pipeline know and when did they know it?
Yeah, I mean, look, one thing that's kind of irritating me about that, I mean, look, there's plenty of bad takes on this, but I just find that everyone focusing on the need to like regulate the energy sector and pipelines and stuff and do a big security uplift. I mean, it's my feeling that that just won't really get us there, which is why for the last few years I've been banging on about trying to, you know, tackle this stuff with more offense, more offensive measures, because the security uplift, it'll take too long and it'll cost too much. I mean, what's your thought on that?
So, I mean, I generally think you're right, but at the same time, I think we can isolate out some of the issues that need to be addressed immediately. And you and I have talked about ransomware now for over a year and how we need to change our approach. You know, from a requirements perspective, you know, we'll have the regulation conversation, and that'll take 6 months to a year, if not longer, on, you know, what sectors do you regulate, you know, to what extent. But in the meantime, I think there's some low-hanging fruit. I think just from a table stakes perspective, we don't understand the extent of the ransomware, you know, the damage here in the United States or elsewhere. There are too many organizations that just aren't reporting it. So I think table stakes is some sort of mandatory reporting requirement for any sort of extortion, cyber extortion or ransomware scheme. I think that's easy to do right now. And yeah, you could put a threshold in there somewhere, but we've got to get more data so we really get a better understanding of how big this thing is.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one thing we've got to make clear is we're certainly not saying that this is a state-backed activity, but, you know, there's been a lot of reporting recently on how certain countries, Russia chiefly, do provide a safe operating environment for these crews. How much do you think this is going to rise to the level of being sort of a geopolitical issue? We already had Biden at a press conference saying, well, this isn't a Russian state-sponsored attack as far as our intelligence services can gather, but this ransomware did come from Russia, so maybe that's something they want to take care of. I mean, that was a pretty overt and clear signal from the get-go that the Biden administration is looking to Russia and saying, hey, you know, maybe you want to clean this up.
I think there are three possibilities. First is that in the ransomware actor, DarkSide or others, are truly independent free agents that float around and you know, commit their crimes outside of the influence, the approval, the sphere of any state actor. I think the second possibility is where a crew operates within the sovereign territory of a nation that turns a blind eye, and they could turn a blind eye for a couple reasons. One is that it builds a strategic cyber force. You actually have some people that are developing some talent that you might be able to call on down the road. The second is that it's bringing revenue in. It's bringing revenue into a otherwise, you know, economically depressed country. And then the third option is it's actually giving meaningful, and I'm using my air quotes here, meaningful employment to Russian youth. So they're not out doing something else. They're focusing their energy outside of the boundaries or the borders of the Russian Federation. And so that's a tacit approval state. And then the third, which is what we have seen previously, is where there's active coordination and collaboration between ransomware crews and intelligence agencies. If you look back to some of the prior Department of Justice and Treasury sanctions, there are linkages between Evil Corp and the FSB. So those are, you know, this is going to fall somewhere in one of those three buckets. Maybe there's another bucket, but I think those are the range of operations. And if it's two or three, yes, there's going to be some degree of culpability that attaches to Russia, because this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And so then the follow-on question is, well, what's the off-ramp, right? You know, did they expect or anticipate it to go?
Well, I think my go-to joke on this one is, don't be surprised to see the affiliates who did this like thrown over the fence into the US embassy grounds in Moscow by a couple of goons, you know. I don't think anyone's happy that this happened, right?
Or just disappeared, right? Or, you know, it happens to live in one of those high-rise apartments with the faulty balconies.
Yeah.
The railings. Yeah. I just, there are a couple shoes left to drop, I have a feeling, on this one.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of, you know, the stuff that you and I have, we've spoken about this, you know, as you mentioned earlier, over the last sort of year, I mean, to what degree do you think this pipeline shutdown is going to result in the mobilization of agencies that until now haven't really been tasked with seriously combating this threat?
I think it's already there, and I think that movement has been afoot. At least the trend lines have been underway for a year or so. And in part, that goes back to the protection of the 2020 election, where we were concerned about ransomware as a threat to voter registration databases, for instance. But the challenge here is that the intelligence community only has so many resources. You know, they have a finite set of actors, collection capacity, and those tend to be fully tasked up. And so the question we have to ask ourselves, or the leadership has to ask in the White House, National Security Council, and elsewhere, is that has ransomware broken
that threshold? Yeah.
Yeah. And are they now something from a national security perspective? And so we will start putting collection against it. And that's just, again, you talk about, you know, human condition. That's the condition of the intelligence community. They go do what they're told to do. And, you know, until they're told to do something, it's kind of hard to make it a priority. But look, I mean, the hybrid approach we're going to have to take here to counter ransomware, I've called out before, I think I've said on your show before, and then my former counterpart from the UK's NCSC calls it the ransomware triplet. But first is that we, you know, there's no question that we have to improve defenses. If you, FireEye just today, Tuesday, released a blog or a review of some of their dark side responses, and what they've seen is initial infection vector is one of three things. It was either a sonic wall CVE, I think it's 2021-216, and then some of just the perimeter credential compromises, so VPNs and you know that slew of VPNs that we've had over the last couple of years, and then a Google Drive link and an email, and that's all fairly basic stuff that you would expect. And so we're going to have to continue and increase defenses, both state and locals, who tend to get the bulk of this activity, as well as in the private sector. But the conversation that we've had is the second bucket of the triplet, and that's breaking the business model.
Yep.
And how do we make it so crime doesn't pay?
Yeah.
Right. You know,
go after the Bitcoins, go after the people who are the corrupt officials who sort of shield these people, that sort of stuff. I mean, there's a lot you can do there.
Yeah, you know, and for one, you know, cryptocurrencies have a point of intersection with the conventional economy, the kiosks, the over-the-counter trading desks, some of the exchange wallets. Those things, you know, you can extract some financial leverage on and regulatory leverage on them there. Now, the bigger question, I think, is, you know, is in the West and in the US, is cryptocurrency a fintech that we want to embrace and we want to innovate in, that we want to be globally competitive? Because you know, if you regulate too hard, you turn the screws too hard, then you drive the market out of the US and it goes elsewhere. I think China's already made its bet. They're all in on cryptocurrencies. So we've got to kind of, you know, we've got to intervene in a way that addresses the societal harms, but can still allow for innovation.
I had the chief researcher from Chainalysis, or the chief scientist from Chainalysis, on the program not so long ago, and you know we were discussing the proposed Treasury KYC stuff for Bitcoin, and even them, I mean they track badness on the blockchain. Even they were like, wow, that seems a bit harsh, right? So, but you're right. This has become a very big part of the conversation very, very quickly. It almost feels like it's come out of nowhere. But KYC for crypto, you think it's happening?
I mean, it's certainly on the table, but that's kind of the beauty of the blockchain and cryptocurrency, is the immutable nature and the forensic capabilities that are built in to cryptocurrencies. And you know, how do we make that work for us in a positive way that can reduce certain societal harms?
Yeah.
So that, you know, then there's always the natural conversation about do you outlaw ransom payments, and that's a really hard thing to do.
Well, goodbye Garmin. That's just one example. That's my counterpoint. Anytime anyone suggests that, Garmin the company wouldn't exist if it were not able to make ransom payments. And even in that case, they paid a sanctioned entity. Even these sanctions, we've got a news item this week saying something like 15 or 20% of ransomware payments coming out of the US are probably violating sanctions. So, yeah. I mean, even that approach didn't work. So I do wonder.
Yeah. And then third, and this was kind of, I think you're the one that really first flagged this, is that there are a whole set of national security tools and levers that governments, national governments and authorities have. And we just haven't fully deployed those, whether in the US it's Title 10 or Title 50. Title 50 is the intelligence agencies. You know, you put more intelligence capacity or capabilities against it, you prioritize. Title 10, you look at some of the things Cyber Command could do to target, ideally in coordination with the private sector, command and control infrastructure. I mean, you can make a dent in this. And then there's the diplomatic piece and geopolitical levers where you can come together as a group of nations and you know, whether it has worked in the past or not, but, you know, call the ball on Russia. And I think, you know, for his part, and he pointed this out, President Biden said he's meeting with President Putin in June, potentially. And
yeah,
it's a great opportunity to have a face-to-face conversation about shutting down the pipelines in the United States.
Yeah, I think that'll be, that might come up, you'd imagine.
Yeah, among other things, right?
Among other things. All right, Chris Krebs, thank you so much for finding time in your schedule to have a chat to us about all of this. I mean, you're absolutely the right person to have on the show to discuss this with. And yeah, all the best. It's great to have you back, by the way. I know you've had a very difficult few months, but you know, all the best to you from here on out. It sounds like things are improving.
Thanks, Pat. Living the dream. Living the dream.
So there is Chris Krebs living the dream and making some good points, Adam.
Yeah, no, he certainly does. I mean, and talking about some of the ways to, you know, address it with Russia, and some of the motivations for Russia, I thought were quite interesting there, right? To think about, you know, the fact that it brings in, you know, foreign currency and it brings in employment opportunities. Like, that's a,
I don't know that I was totally on board for that part of it, because I don't think it's actually, you know, I don't know how many, just quite how many jobs are in this, you know?
Yeah, but there certainly seems to be plenty of people doing it. And, you know, I do feel a little bit bad, I guess, for, you know, whichever affiliate was responsible for this particular campaign, because having this degree of attention, you know, from the US government, you know, from people very closely affiliated, like, you know, Krebs, with kind of a history of understanding how the responses, you know, what the response options are. And then on the other side, he's also, you know, the kid is also, whoever it was, has also, you know, embarrassed the dark side crew,
yeah,
and they're going to be feeling some of the pressure. And you really got to wonder, like, which of those groups coming after you is, I mean, maybe going and turning yourself into the embassy. Maybe that's a better plan than having the balcony accident.
I'll take prison in the United States instead of a balcony accident. Yeah.
I mean, maybe, right? It's probably warmer, at least, in prison.
Oh, you know, it's just, I mean, what a world. And, you know, it probably is, like, a lot of these affiliates have terrible OPSEC, and a lot of them are, as you say, kids, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if the US has a bead on who did this already, right? Like, I would not be surprised at all.
No, I don't think I would be either. And even, you know, without the full weight of the intelligence, you know, US intelligence apparatus looking into it, yeah, I mean, there's certainly a variety of capacities to have good OPSEC, you know, amongst the people doing this kind of thing. And this degree of attention, you know, is going to shake down everybody who's involved, right? Because, I mean, you know, there's lots of parts of this kind of, you know, of the groups and of the ecosystem, and, you know, people are going to know, and everyone's going to want to make their distance. And yeah, I'm glad that it's not me, right? I'm glad that I have a legit job, even if the tooling is the same. You know, at least we get paid for different things, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, Newt Gingrich, too, is out there saying that the United States should assassinate these guys, which is pretty funny, because I'm pretty sure that's what he said about Julian Assange, isn't it? I mean, I think his thing is to periodically just pop up and remind people outside the United States that he exists by suggesting that various people get shot.
I mean, yeah, I don't think it's going to solve the problem in this particular case. And yeah, taking advice from Newt Gingrich, probably also not the world's best plan. But, I mean, hey, it's on the continuum of options that are available to us.
Yeah. Look, in the follow-up conversation that I had with Chris, one thing that really struck me about this is the United States has an agency called Cyber Command. And currently your police, schools, hospitals, and now oil pipelines are being pantsed by pretty low-level threat actors based out of cybers, Russia. Yes. Like, why do you have an agency called Cyber Command if it's not going to do stuff in the cybers when you're being attacked in the cybers?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, man.
Yeah, that's a good question. What exactly would you say that you do here, Cyber Command?
Yeah. You know, and maybe it's not the military option, you know, because they're a military agency. You know, it's look, it's going to be a blended approach, right? Obviously, course, that solves this problem. And as you heard Chris say, like a lot, you know, it's not like intelligence agencies don't have other stuff to do.
Yes, this is very, very true. Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff is high stakes, right? But you just got to think they've got to really ramp this up. And you got to think, like, if this doesn't do it, where does this go next?
Yes,
right?
Exactly right. If this doesn't do it, what exactly are we waiting for?
Yeah.
You know, water or what, right? I mean, power, electricity, but it's pretty close, right? Energy, you know, especially if they don't sort the actual logistics of getting the pipeline back up and running and de-escalate, like, yeah, what else are you waiting for? Like, yeah. What else are we going to see?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see how this all shakes out. But I have a feeling that, you know, I have a feeling that I've prematurely called this before in cases like the DC. Well, though, surely they must act now. And, you know, 600 hospitals last year or whatever it was, surely they must act now. But, you know, again, it's America and oil, right? Like, I mean, anyone who doesn't get that reference just is pretty young, I'm guessing.
And maybe some of the people doing this are not quite old enough to remember how the whole, you know, Iraq situation kicked off. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and not just Iraq either. Like, you know, if you want to get Lockheeded, this is how you get Lockheeded, basically.
This is how you get Lockheeded.
Yeah. Moving to some other ransomware news, and the city of Tulsa in the United States, Tulsa, Oklahoma, has been hit with ransomware as well. And yeah, there's this apparent Avedon ransomware crew or variant targeting a whole bunch of people. We've seen a warning. We've seen warnings from the Australian Cybersecurity Center and the FBI on that one.
Yeah, there seems to be, you know, another up-and-coming ransomware crew targeting, you know, all the sorts of industries you would imagine, and yeah, hitting network edge perimeter devices, using that for initial access, and onwards to, you know, the same sort of double whammy, you know, exfil and encrypt extortion approach that we've seen other people. So yeah, more people in the market doing their thing.
And we're starting to see some data leak out of the DC police thing, which we mentioned, you know, we mentioned the DC police thing earlier. They got themselves ransomware and a whole bunch of their data stolen. We're seeing things like personnel files being leaked. Also, we've seen we've got a bit of insight into the negotiations between the ransomware crew and the Metropolitan Police Department, Adam.
Yeah, I was a little surprised actually to see that, you know, they are actually negotiating, or were negotiating, you know, with the ransomware operators and offering to pay money. Not the amount of money that the ransomware crew wanted, but the fact that, you know, a police force is offering to pay a ransom at all did surprise me a little bit.
I'm going to have a go at him here and like say that their offer was egregious lowballing. Like,
and it was a bit rude.
Yeah, I mean, the ransomware crew is asking for $4 million and the police offered him 100K, and it's like, That's just going to make them mad.
Exactly. That's not, you know, you would hope that police negotiators were a little smoother than that, but maybe they had to outsource it to ransomware negotiators who, you know how to use Tor or whatever.
Yeah, I'm seeing talk elsewhere as well that insurance companies are starting to really rethink paying this stuff, which is interesting because, you know, you got to remember a lot of the money that's going to these crews is coming from the insurance companies, and there is talk now they're going to turn the tap off. Have you caught wind of that as well?
Yeah, there was some reporting that AXA, one of the big insurers, had announced that they weren't going to pay out, at least in France. It didn't appear to be a global policy. But yeah, starting to make a move there that, you know, French people don't pay ransoms and, you know, trying to make policies that work, you know, for the French market. So they've said that they're not going to pay because it creates, you know, weird incentives. I think AXA in the US came out and said actually, you know, that we will still be selling it here because different market. But yeah, we're starting to see some rumblings that perhaps it's not a particularly helpful long-term plan, you know, for the insurers to kind of
Well, to keep funding paying. Criminal gangs yeah. that are crippling the economy. Geez, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to keep sending them dump trucks of money. Who'd have thought? What else have we got here? Look, I'm linking through to a release from the Department of Justice, the US Department of Justice, in this week's show notes. It's interesting. It's the IRS, man, the tax office in the United States, is going after Kraken users, and they're trying to get a whole bunch of, and that was a cryptocurrency exchange. They're trying to get a whole bunch of data on Americans who've been using Kraken, like anyone who did over 20K in transactions. So this is just interesting, right? Because a lot of the conversation that sort of popped up this year about KYC and cryptocurrency and trying to cut out ransomware and just crime generally has focused on cryptocurrency regulation. And now we see the tax office getting in on the action. It does feel like maybe the Bitcoin crime party, I don't know if it's over, but they're certainly maybe calling last drinks.
It does seem that way. And I think, you know, a lot of the people that, you know, thought that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies were going to be a really kind of freewheeling, you know, place outside of the reach of the tax office, probably going to find this a little confronting. But, you know, if they're going to have regulation and know your customer and all those kind of requirements, hey, it makes sense that they may as well also pay tax.
Well, two things in life, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly.
So, yeah. We'll see how they go with that and we'll see what the approach is. But I think also just regulators and, you know, DOJ's understanding of blockchain and like how traceable this stuff is, that's come a long way, right? So we could expect to see more of these sorts of actions targeting historical activity. We got one here from Catalan over at The Record talking about the UK and US sharing the details of more vulnerabilities being exploited by APT29, Cozy Bear.
Yeah, they've expanded the list of kind of techniques and bugs that particular crew has been using, and none of them are particularly, all of them are things that you would expect them to be using, you know, pulse bugs and F5 bugs, that kind of thing. But what we have seen is when they published a bunch of details around the operating techniques of that particular crew, they were forced to kind of change those techniques, and by publishing a whole bunch more, you're kind of shaking up their day-to-day lives and, you know, keeping them bogged down writing new procedure docs or whatever else. So even if nothing else, I mean, you probably got IOCs for a lot of these bugs in your environment if you're serious anyway. But yeah, if anything, it might shake up you know, a day in the office over at Cozy Bear.
I mean, it's just ripped straight from the headlines though. You know, F5, Big IP, you've got Oracle Web Logic. You know, it's just all the stuff you'd expect. Exchange.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny too because I see this list of bugs and I'm like, that's pretty much the tool bag that Adam would take to work at the moment in 2021.
Right? Exactly, so, right?
Yeah. Now, we spoke about how Intrusion Truth, you know, had a little problem with their Twitter account and we anticipated that it would come back and it has, and they have dropped a blog post and they're promising more juicy, juicy info.
Yeah, they are. They're talking about a couple of Chinese hackers that are involved with some front companies. And they've kind of built this picture of, you know, what it looks like to operate one of these, you know, kind of part private sector, part government operated kind of hacker firms in China and the structure of those. And then they've tied together a bunch of the kind of company records and used that to, you know, kind of pivot around and identify these couple of guys. And there's some, you know, the usual sorts of details you'd expect from Intrusion Truth about who these people are and where they went to school and all that kind of thing. And then they're saying that there is also typically a government officer that's involved, you know, intelligence officer that's involved in running these companies, and that's who they're going to dox next in the next exciting episode.
Yes, yes. Intrusion Truth, which is totally not affiliated or associated with the US government at all. but, you know, their content keeps getting validated in Department of Justice indictments. Gee, funny that. Anyway, what else have we got here? Oh, yeah, we got a good one here from Sean Lingus over at Cyberscoop talking about how the United States or the intelligence agencies in the United States are starting to look at the supply chain risk associated with software development in Russia. I mean, there are some really talented engineers in Russia. I know someone who did a major web application project. This is going back a while ago, but he had the whole thing done in Russia and they did it. Really bang up job for a good price, you know. So there are a lot of companies that outsource to Russia, and you know, now there's some people in the United States really looking at this and going, is that something we want in our supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, this makes sense as part of a larger kind of conversation about, you know, how much you trust supply chain, both software and hardware, and, you know, kind of ongoing maintenance, all that kind of thing. You know, it's the parallels with, you know, China and Huawei and the various other vendors there. You know, it kind of makes sense that this is, you know, a thing that absolutely you should, you know, think about. I mean, if you were running Iranian firewalls in the US, maybe you'd want to rethink that too. So, you know, in the context of the geopolitics, it makes sense to think about, you know, the kind of tying it to SolarWinds when that was, you know, much more American company that just happened to get hacked by Russians, you know, kind of doesn't make, there's an immediate line there. But in terms of the bigger picture supply chain, you know, now that we're starting to think about that on a global geopolitical kind of, you know, with a lens of global geopolitics, yeah, sure, it makes sense to go through and understand where your suppliers are, where their suppliers are, how the outsourcing works, all those kinds of things. But it's hard, right? Because you know, you don't get to see a lot of this stuff from the outside.
Well, I think this sends a pretty strong signal to American companies that might have outsourced development taking place in Russia that they might want to think about some contingencies in case the hammer drops. I mean, it is unfortunate that if there's follow through on this, you know, a lot of engineers in Russia are going to lose their jobs, which really sucks.
Yeah, I mean, in the, you know, idealized, you know, globalized world, we wouldn't be worried about such things. But yeah, I think if you did have large offshore dev teams, yeah, it would make sense to think about what the contingency looks like. And yeah, if you work in one of those, it may be a rough time, and yeah, think about other opportunities.
Now, a bunch of outlets are covering this next story. And look, they've kind of, in my view, they've kind of hyped it up. It's still a very interesting top line number. I mean, Dan Gooden's one that he wrote up for Ars, which is appearing on Wired. The headline is "Apple Execs Chose to Keep a Hack of 128 Million iPhones Quiet." And Dan's not the only one who had this story. You know, pretty much everyone had it. What's funny about this, though, is they're saying, yeah, 128 million iPhone users got hacked. Well, kinda. This is actually in reference to the Xcode ghost thing, which you and me just thought was the most hilarious story. That's when someone developed a Trojaned version of the Xcode development suite and basically put it on torrent, you know, on BitTorrent, because the real one was kind of slow to download from Apple. So everybody just started using this one. And I mean, we knew the impact was big, but we didn't know that it was 128 million users big.
Yeah, we'd seen, like, when this was originally dropped, we saw something like, what, 40 apps, and then they got expanded to, you know, a few thousand apps that have been built with this pirated version of Xcode. And then the backdoor it included kind of, like, sent off a bunch of information, but then, you know, it was a bit unclear whether there was a subsequent, you know, ability to load code or exactly kind of what the impact of this was going to be. But, you know, 100 million users, I mean, that would have to be one of the more significant.
I mean, it'd have to be one of the biggest hacks in history, right? Like, really, if you're talking about attacker code running on victim devices, it would have to be one of the biggest in the world. But I don't know that the impact is particularly noteworthy. I mean, there's nothing here that says there was an impact.
Yeah, but it's certainly big from the point of view of the Apple App Store, where we haven't really seen the kind of widespread backdoor apps like we have seen in other environments. But yeah, in terms of actual impact, you know, to the people who had installed these apps, yeah, there really wasn't much evidence that there was significant impact. But then, yeah, the reporting here has been about Apple's response to this that came up in their lawsuit with Epic Games. There's a bunch of emails that were in the discovery for that, which looked at Apple's kind of internal process where they were discussing how to notify their users. And then some looking around seems to suggest that they didn't actually follow through the process of notifying people who had downloaded apps that were infected. So that's kind of why the story has now resurfaced.
Yeah, because it's being portrayed as Apple sort of sweeping it under the rug. But can you imagine being the lone attacker who comes up with this, you know, compromised compiler, throws it out there on BitTorrent? You're like, sweet, I'm going to set up a Netcat listener on this box to collect some shells. And then you get 128 million shells. Like, that's why I don't worry about this. I mean, even if I did have one of these apps, I mean, what's an attacker going to do with 128 million shells?
Exactly. Like, I mean, even just handling that many shells, going to need load balancer.
I mean, that's the thing, right? It's death by a shell, like crushed by your own shells.
That would be pretty funny, being, yeah, denial of service right off the network.
Yeah, pretty much.
The incoming shell sin floods.
That's definitely the dog that caught the car, much like the Dark Side affiliates who attack Colonial. This next one, we don't have too much time to discuss it. It's kind of like cyber adjacent, if you will. But it's a fantastic story by Jack Murphy and Zach Dorfman at Yahoo News, looking at the Trump administration's planning in assassinating Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general. And it's just a fascinating read. There's a lot of cool intelligence related stuff in there. It's just a great piece, and I just really wanted to include it in this week's show.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly worth a read, and there are certainly some cyber adjacent bits, you know, like how they went and backdoored phones in the supply chain, you know, even though Iran had pretty good operational security and pretty good attempts at buying phones, for example, off the regular supply chain, and the techniques the CIA used to backdoor those. So yeah, some of those certainly cyber adjacent, and yeah, definitely worth a read.
Yeah, and sort of gives you a bit of a peek into what the Trump admin actually wanted to do, which was a lot more than just killing Soleimani's. And it's a little bit, you know, a little bit of sobering reading for sure. Now, we've got some interesting research here. This was interesting enough for you to actually drop a link into Slack this morning. What was that CVE you dropped yesterday?
Yeah, there was someone found a CVE in like a universal Turing machine from 1967 that would, you know, take malicious input and result in executing arbitrary Turing tapes. So that was pretty cool.
And I was so glad I dropped what I was doing to look into that when you pasted the link, because wow. But we've got some good stuff here, which is some Wi-Fi related security research that actually looks pretty real.
Yeah, this is some really interesting research from Matthew Van Hoof, who's looked into a bunch of, you know, other modern wireless bugs. And this is a set of somewhat related bugs going, you know, right back to the original 802.11 standards, where the net result is an attacker who is on the radio segment between a client and the rest of the network, which is more straightforward to do than you might think, who doesn't have crypto keys, is able to inject plain text packets into the communication stream. And if you craft that just right, you can then use that to, you know, kind of leverage onwards for other attacks. And the basic guts of this is that an attacker sets up a, you know, a web server or something on the internet that sends in, you know, packets that contain a second wireless frame inside the payload portion of the regular packet. And then on the wireless network, you kind of flip a bit that says, hey, this wireless frame contains a fragmented, you know, multiple packets all joined together, and then the wireless drivers will unpack them and then misparse the data coming in from the attacker as a new frame and then inject that into the network stack, you know, without the attacker ever having to know the crypto keys.
Just to be clear, you're talking about a remote web server, not one on the same wireless network or something. You're talking
about it's a combination where you have to have wireless proximity to kind of, there's a bit in the header which basically says this message contains multiple messages. So you have to be proximate to flip that bit on the radio, and then you need to be able to send packets that the upstream network, the access point, is going to encrypt on your behalf and send to the victim kind of wireless station. So it's a combination of local wireless attack plus being able to influence the contents of the communication coming back in from the internet. So it's a little bit fiddly. And there are some other, so he's described some design flaws, and that's the one I'm talking about here, which is the way
it's proximity plus a remote.
Okay. But he's also come up with a bunch of implementation flaws that are related, that he would have discovered whilst investigating this design flaw, that in certain wireless drivers or certain wireless devices, you don't have to have that requirement of being able to send packets from the internet as well. So there's some like implementation flaws in individual devices, and then there's this kind of design flaw with how, you know, you pack multiple frames into one, or how you fragment a frame across multiple frames, that kind of thing. So really interesting for, you know, people doing wireless pen testing, people doing, you know, attacks that involve proximity. And in some cases, you know, for certain, you know, kind of low budget wireless devices, IoT things, there may be some more impactful attacks where you can just like, you know, straight up send packets without encrypting them, for example, where like the driver doesn't validate that the incoming packet is actually encrypted at all, even though it's on an encrypted network. So that's the sort of thing you'd see on a, you know, IoT device or something rubbishy like that.
Yeah. And this is the sort of stuff that unlikely to really get comprehensively fixed, you'd imagine.
Certainly the standards-based stuff, I mean, in the case of the design flaw, there already is a mechanism in some of the standards to address it, but no one implements it, which is, you know, the wireless spec has gotten more and more complicated over the years, and that's not super surprising. So yeah, it's going to be a long tail on this one, and, you know, you're not going to see widespread hacking as a result of it, but there's certain, you know, I was
it
reading that paper.
It gives options to people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, like I looked at that paper and I thought, because I mean, wireless as an initial entry vector or as initial credential gathering vector is a thing we've done on a bunch of red teams over the years. Like it is a useful, like if you're near someone's office building or whatever else, it does give you options. And looking at this one, yeah, there's definitely some thoughts to be had and some planning to be done about how feasible this is going to be to do in the field.
I've even seen a very funny photo of you camouflaged and hiding in a bush while holding an antenna out on a job, doing a wireless job. You looked very, very, you know, tactical. You were ATAS, all tactical, you know?
I'm so tactical. Yep.
So tactical. We've also got some bugs affecting Qualcomm chipsets, CVE there, apparently affecting 30% of all smartphones. Look, a lot of these things, you know, the impact is so narrow. I didn't really get a chance to look into this one. Is that the case here, or is this more of a, oh my God? I figured if it was oh my God, we would have heard more about it.
Yeah, I don't know that it's completely in the oh my God category. This is essentially like memory corruption when you can send QMI messages. A QMI is a management protocol used for communicating with Qualcomm cellular modems. So if you can send QMI management messages to the modem, then there's some memory corruption. And that's not a thing that normally like an app on a phone could do.
Yeah, like by the time you can do that, you're already kind of there.
Yeah, exactly. So that avenue is not super concerning. There may be some avenues where QMI messages are used when you're, you know, like handling messages off the air. So if you can reach the vulnerable code path, say through sending a text message, across the radio or across the mobile network in general, then that might be more interesting. So that if you can do it from the radio side into the baseband, then that's certainly more concerning. But the research so far didn't seem to be conclusive about whether or not there were viable avenues for that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Qualcomm's publishing some fixes, but as usual with this kind of stuff, like, it's up to the individual phone vendors to go roll out baseband patches from Qualcomm. No one's going to do that.
No, they're not.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's research from Checkpoint, so well done to them for that. Now, this story, I love this story, written by Tim Starks over at CyberScoop. Apparently, Google is going to make multi-factor authentication the default for its users, which is just amazing.
Yeah, this is certainly about time they pulled this one together. So, yeah, if you sign up for Google services, you're going to get pushed into the multi-factor enrollment flow by default. You'll be able to opt out if you want, but pushing people through this by default absolutely is going to make a difference to the number of people using it. And obviously, multi-factor is one of the best controls that we've got to reduce account abuse.
Now, some evidence here that the Chinese military is taking a what you might call an unhealthy interest in Western antivirus products. Adam, this is a story, another one by Catalin Kimpanu over at The Record. And, you know, we know that, various Chinese APT crews have been targeting stuff like Trend Micro AV. And, they've been just, they're even doing the right thing and buying it to tear it down instead of just torrenting it or whatever.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of the nice bit about this was the reporting shows that they've been actually buying commercial licenses for, dozens of different Western antivirus products, kind of 20 seat licenses for enterprise versions of antivirus products. And then, this is the crew that was using Trend Micro Bugs in Taiwan. So kind of makes sense that they're not buying these. These are English language editions as well, like not the Chinese localized versions of, McAfee or whatever. Kind of makes sense that perhaps they're not buying it to defend themselves.
Yes, I would think they're not. buying it to defend themselves, but it's just funny when you see the evidence of that sort of stuff leaking out, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a peek behind the curtain sort of thing. Yeah. Peloton. Peloton's been having a hard time lately. I mean, they had a great time. I mean, I'm convinced the COVID-19 pandemic was in part engineered by Peloton so that they could sell their silly bicycles, but, to people who could no longer leave their houses. But they've been having some security-related drama lately, Adam.
Yeah, it sounds like so they make a bunch of connected exercise equipment and mobile apps that drive all that sort of stuff. Anyway, turns out that some of the APIs used by their equipment initially had no authentication, and so you could just go and pull user data off their APIs, which of course bunch of people then scrape some stuff out. This was reported to them by pentest partners. They responded by adding authentication to the APIs, which good move. But not adding authorization. So I think anyone who had a Peloton account could then just make API calls and pull the same data out. Has now subsequently been addressed, but their response did not look particularly effective, judging by the timeline from pentest partners.
I mean, I imagine that, they're one of those companies that just got smacked in the ass by a rainbow when the pandemic hit. And, their business just went berserk. A couple of friends of mine in the US have them, and they are irritated by the extent to which they enjoy them. they're straight up disappointed in themselves for really loving their Peloton. So there you go. The DoD in the United States is expanding its vulnerability disclosure program. So they're, opening up a whole bunch more stuff for people to go and hack away at. I mean, this is great, right? Like, I would like to see this, just carte blanche, everyone just, go for it. I mean, it's just a good step.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of nice to see the evolution of this program, which started out pretty tightly scoped to now essentially, as far as I understand it, anything DoD is pretty much fair game. If it's on the internet, you can go hack it under the aegis of their bug bounty program, which that's a pretty good place to be and kind of shows a level of, increasing maturity in handling that. And also, recognizing that, hey, attackers don't care about scope. If we let everybody else go at it, then that's probably a good thing. So, yeah, good on them.
Google and Mozilla looking at, this headline is from Ben Dixon at The Daily Swig, which is Portswigger's news service. Google and Mozilla will bake HTML sanitization into their browsers. Is this as good as it sounds, Adam?
This certainly makes sense for some classes of bug. This is addressing kind of the client side, like DOM-based X cross-site scripting. And there's been a number of ways for developers to kind of try and sanitize HTML, when they're handling it in JavaScript on the client side. But keeping those up to date, keeping those tracking the standards has always been difficult. Obviously, the browser knows how to parse HTML, and it makes sense for the browser manufacturers to kind of provide HTML sanitization as a service that the browser, is just in the standard APIs. And that seems to be where things are heading. So that's it. Good move.
And we're going to end with a comedy story.
This is so good. I love it.
This is so funny. So, you know, there's those directories on the open web which give you the onion addresses of, like, you know, dark markets. One of them is called dark.fail. And someone took it over using a pretty clever approach.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Darkfail had their DNS registrar account hijacked by an attacker who made a fake German court order saying that the German police were going to take it over, and they sent it off to the domain, actually to the upstream domain registrar. So there was a privacy-focused registrar that actually handled the dark.fail site, but they didn't do fail registration, so they actually outsourced that to like Namecheap/2cows.
That's never something you want to hear, you know?
Never a good sign. Anyway, so whoever did this makes a fake court order with like a gag order that says you can't talk about it and sends it upstream to 2cows. Saying, hey, we're seizing this site, please hand over control to us. And then they transfer it off to another registrar.
But I think that's actually the only way to get 2cows to do anything.
Probably.
You've got to threaten them with the full force of the German government, but do go on.
And then they put up a clone of the Darkfail site with links to all the onions. And then all of those were like scraped front ends for the real thing, but scraping login details and had replaced all of the Bitcoin addresses with the attackers to try and steal all the money as they proxy people onwards back to the real, you know, dark markets or whatever was going on, which is such a beautiful scam.
Well, Adam, a pleasure as always to chat to you, my friend. That is actually it for the week's news. That was a good one. Good week of news. It's been great to chat to you, man, and we'll catch you again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks also to Chris Krebs for joining the show. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now with Okta's Aaron Parecki. He is the editor of the OAuth spec at the IETF and also serves as a senior security architect at Okta. And he is joining us today to talk about how the IETF's latest OAuth spec is shaping up. The TLDR is it's going to contain much better guidance for developers. Here's Aaron.
Yeah, so in the OAuth working group, we are working on updating the OAuth spec to try to provide better guidance around how to build secure apps and APIs using OAuth. A lot of the original part of the OAuth spec, the OAuth core spec, left a lot of decisions up to people who are implementing things. And there's definitely ways to do it in a not very secure way. So we're trying to now update that guidance that is now 10 years old and provide a better starting point for people building things using OAuth.
I mean, this seems a little overdue, to be honest, because I can think back to people who made, you know, developed various techniques and then hit 10 bug bounties at once with those techniques. A lot of stuff involving, you know, being able to use funny domains, like the configs being a little bit too permissive in that regard. But I mean, more recently, the thing that sticks in my mind is Apple's bodging of OAuth with their biometrics thing. I mean, that kind of went off the rails a little bit as well. And you sort of think, I mean, Apple are notoriously competent, if you will. And if they're having a hard time with it, you got to start wondering if it's them or if it's the tool they're working with.
Yeah, that's fair. Apple took it looks like, as far as I can tell, I don't have any inside information on this, but from when that launched, signed with Apple, I did a deep dive and started digging into what they were working on. And it looked like they took OpenID Connect and implemented parts that they understood and left out a lot of the parts that maybe weren't clear about why they were in there that were actually very important security features.
Yeah.
And the OpenID Connect Foundation actually wrote up a whole open letter saying, here are problems that we see with your implementation. Here are parts of the spec that you've ignored. Please fix it. Please implement these things in order for this to actually be secure. And they did eventually update the implementation. So it is.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing after the second time they had a issue facing this, they were able to actually get the resources they needed to get it done, right? But I think, you know, I'm not trying to bash on Apple here. I think the point I'm making is that this is a thing that's been always has been pretty easy to get wrong.
It is. Yeah, it's a complicated space. Anytime you're dealing with these sort of cross, you know, between browsers and apps and servers and all these redirects and stuff, there's a lot of ways that can fail, and a lot of things aren't necessarily obvious about how to get it wrong.
So look, before we get into the IETF document and what the new advice is, like what are the things people are still most commonly getting wrong when it comes to using OAuth? It seems to have gotten better, but I imagine there's, you know, every time you address an old set of issues, there's usually a new set that crop up in their place.
Yeah, fair enough. A lot of the things that we've been seeing are around the redirect URLs. So there's been a lot of those bug bounties that you've seen around lack of proper validation of redirect URLs, which basically means that the attacker is able to send the victim to arbitrary locations for various reasons. And it usually ends up being chained with other redirects or as part of other attacks or using a legitimate OAuth server as part of attack. It's not even an attack on that OAuth server necessarily. But the fact that there is that open redirect, you can use that to chain it with other vulnerabilities that then lead to pretty surprisingly bad flaws.
That's interesting, right? Because I asked you what the new issues were, and it sounds like the new issues are still kind of like stem from the old issues, which is this poorly handled redirect stuff or people not restricting that stuff.
Yeah, that's definitely a big one. There's another sort of class of problems that are being tackled in the OAuth group that tend to be focused more in specific verticals, like the financial industry. Yeah. And that is the whole idea of app impersonation. This is a problem that's actually not even unique to OAuth, but it's very relevant to OAuth. And that's the idea that when you are doing an OAuth flow, you're authorizing an app to access data, right? You're granting it an access token that can go and make requests into your account to fetch data, modify data, whatever that is. So when you are granting that authorization as a user, it's important to understand and to know which application you are granting access to. And that's why you see these consent dialogues like, this is the application that's asking for this kind of access. Do you want to allow this? And that'll be a dialogue that pops up, you know, at the OAuth server. And one of the parts that's kind of mostly unsolved in the realm of native applications is the idea of app identity, which is without the ability to ship credentials to the application, there's no way to really prove that app really is that app. What I mean by that is in an app store distribution model, you can't ship a client secret or any sort of certificate into the application and expect it to remain secret because anybody can download that application and then extract it. So you don't have the ability to use client secrets or even client certificates to authenticate that application when it goes to make requests to the OAuth server. And that's kind of where this problem stems from is without that ability, you lose the ability to really know for certain that this is the application that's making a request and it isn't somebody impersonating that app.
So you're talking from like the authorizing side, you know, not the side that the request is coming from. You're saying, so I'm 0365, how do I know that this app that claims to be X is actually X? That's an interesting thing because, I mean, a lot of the discussion around this stuff has really centered on helping users to make better decisions. But I guess what you're saying is, you know, we need to go one step further and try to solve it from the server side. But that's going to be hard. I mean, for the very fundamental reasons you just mentioned, like you cannot ship like a private key in the app. Right. It doesn't work.
Right. And I don't think we're going to see a solution to that until the OS vendors actually get involved and step in and provide APIs for that kind of thing. But in the meantime, you can solve this issue better in the world of what we call confidential clients, which is the type of application that can be shipped with secrets. And that's going to be all of your server-side apps. So if an app developer is going to go write a web front end to access a banking API, that website's running on a web server somewhere in their data center, presumably. And you know, you can put API keys and environment variables in there all day long, and they won't be visible to the users of the application.
Well, so in an ideal world, that's the...
in an ideal world, assuming you haven't made some really bad mistake.
Yeah.
But actually, along those lines, that's kind of the point here, is that in the sort of traditional OAuth model and what you see in most consumer OAuth APIs, we end up with a client secret as the app's authentication. And a client secret is really just a password for that application.
Yeah.
The client secret is a string that gets put into a config file. It's
stored. A certificate is just really a fancy password, if we're going to be honest, right?
Well, the certificate can be more secure. And that's the thing that we're seeing now being used in OAuth in these more secure deployments. And the reason for it It's only more secure if it can be protected in hardware. Which
yeah, if it's in a HSM, sure, yeah. But I mean, yeah, we don't really... I suppose that's changing, right? Like more and more consumer hardware and like just general office purpose computers are shipping with things like HSMs. Well, I mean, we call them secure enclaves or whatever, but same diff.
Right, right. But in the server side world, you can absolutely do that today. You can use hardware security modules from your server to in order to sign things that are being sent to other servers. And that is one of the recommendations in the financial grade API subset of OAuth and OpenID Connect, which is drop the whole idea of shared secrets and instead use certificate-based authentication.
But this still brings us back to the old problem, which is like the Wi-Fi problem, which is how do you as a user authenticate that you're connecting to the correct access point, right? You basically can't. And this is a very difficult problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems at many different layers of the stack here. And that's kind of one of the challenges with OAuth and why it's so easy to get it wrong and so hard to actually understand if you have a completely secure deployment, because there just are a lot of these layers. And when I like to talk about these as different problems, because they are not all the same problem. They don't have all the same threat profile. They are problems at different layers of the stack. And it's okay to solve one of the problems, even if it doesn't solve a different problem, because you still improve the overall security. So we talk about the client authentication problem, which solves, when you can use certificates, solves a subset of things. And separately, we talk about the app identity problem and use various mechanisms to try to educate users about how to recognize apps. There's the whole issue of, do we know that a user's TLS connection is not being intercepted in, midway to the server? We don't necessarily know that all the time. So these are all different problems.
Look, we are actually running out of time. This has been a very interesting conversation, so we haven't even spoken about the document yet. Can you just tell us, like, top line, what's in the document? Where can people find it?
So there's two active efforts in the OAuth working group right now. There's the security best current practice, which is sort of updating the whole set of 10-year long backlog drafts. That is in progress, very nearly completed. In parallel to that, we were working on OAuth 2.1, which is a sort of one document to roll up all of that best practice. So the idea with OAuth 2.1 is that it is going to be a new baseline for OAuth. And it is not actually describing anything that isn't already described in existing documents, one of which is the security best current practice. And that is so that you don't have to read 10 years of drafts in order to understand what is the best way to do things today.
There's value in aggregation, man. I know it. Don't you worry about that. So this is just really about pulling together, to a large degree, pulling together existing resources, but putting them in one place.
Yeah, and also removing old and secure ways of doing things. Like, for example, the implicit flow, which I've talked about a lot on the internet. And the implicit flow is the least secure way to deliver an access token to an application. So it turns out that it only existed because of a particular limitation in browsers that doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really have a purpose. And because of that, it is being removed from OAuth 2.1. And the security BCP is saying, don't use the implicit flow because it doesn't really serve a purpose. It's the guidance from the group saying, hey, we think you should update your implementations because of these problems. And people may or may not. And we hope they do.
All right, Aaron Paracki, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Biz to talk about these new guidance documents for OAuth. It's been a really interesting chat. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Aaron Paracki there from Okta talking about the OAuth work he's contributing to at the IETF. Big thanks to Aaron for that, and big thanks to Okta for being this week's sponsor and making this week's episode of Risky Business possible. I will be dropping a Snake Oilers episode tomorrow. That one features Google Cloud Security, and they're pitching their Beyond Corp Zero Trust for Enterprise stuff, which I hadn't heard of prior to that interview, and that's pretty cool stuff. So check that one out. An Australian startup called Devicey 2, which basically their whole thing is making Intune usable, which is always a good thing. We got Trend Micro coming along talking about some XDR stuff as well. So do make sure you check that one out. As I say, that one goes live tomorrow, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.